If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm podcast. I am your host, KMO, and this is episode number 359, Stealing from the Future, with guest Mark Rabinowitz, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Wednesday, April 24th, 2013. In this installment of the Sea Realm podcast, I'm going to play a conversation that I recorded just yesterday with Mark Rabinowitz. Mark is a repeat guest on the show. He's the keeper of the blog oilempire.us. And we will be talking about some of the arguments that are being floated in the mainstream media right now about how new extraction methodologies have basically given petroleum-powered civilization centuries in which to get its act together. For those who even think that its act isn't 100% together already. These arguments are actually coming from unexpected directions. For example, Rolling Stone magazine recently published a little essay by Bill McKibben in which Bill McKibben claims that the fossil fuel industry has proved the peak oil theorists wrong, and that now it's time to give up these fanciful notions of peak oil and focus our attention where it really needs to be, which is on getting atmospheric carbon down to below 350 parts per million. Anyway, I'll say more about all of that after I have thanked the sponsors of this week's episode of the Sea Realm podcast. This week I have to thank Richard B., Zachary L., the Occupied Times of London, Tommy B., and Michael C. Several repeat sponsors of the Sea Realm podcast in that list. So thank you to Richard, Zachary, Occupied Times of London, Tommy, and Michael. Sea Realm is a listener-supported podcast, and it is thanks to the generosity of people like the ones I just listed that this program can continue to be a free weekly download for people who are interested in complex conversations, interdisciplinary conversations on difficult topics, the sorts of conversations that you generally do not hear in the corporate media. As I mentioned, I am giving away, as a thank you to generous sponsors of the Sea Realm podcast, copies of my book, Conversations on Collapse. It sells for a ludicrous amount of money on Amazon.com, but a $25 donation anytime in the next week, which is to say before the end of April, will get a copy sent to you in the mail. I have not mailed out any copies yet. So for those of you who donated early and have been waiting patiently, thank you for your patience. The book will be on its way to you quite soon. The music on this week's show comes from Shanimal. The song is called Landlord. I have played Shanimal's music on the podcast before, and it is thanks to my partner in life, the lovely Olga Kay, that I have the music of Shanimal to share with the Sea Realm audience. If you like what you hear, you can find a link to more music by Shanimal in the show notes for this episode on SeaRealm.com. Now, I mentioned the article by Bill McKibben. It's called The Fossil Fuel Resistance, and it appeared in Rolling Stone magazine. You can find it on their website. There is a link to it and a discussion about it in the Friends of the Sea Realm group on Facebook. Another Sea Realm listener sent me a link to a different article on the same topic. It was published in Pacific Standard, and it can be found on their website. Actually, I'm looking at the article now, and the title is The Deluge. It was published on March 4th, and it's written by Vince Beezer. The author writes, "Oil is perhaps the only commodity used in one way or another by almost everyone on Earth. We depend on it for much more than just gasoline. Oil and natural gas provide the raw materials for asphalt, plastics, and chemicals and fertilizers, without which modern agriculture would collapse. To say that we're addicted to oil, as though it were a bad habit we could kick through force of will, is to drastically understate the degree of our dependence. In short, no petroleum, no modern civilization. Little surprise, then, that practically since we started using this stuff, we have fretted that we were running out of it. In 1922, a federal commission predicted that production of oil cannot maintain its present rate. In 1977, President Jimmy Carter declared the world oil production would peak by 1985. It turns out, though, that the problem has never been exactly about supply. It's always been about our ability to profitably tap that supply. We human beings have consumed over our entire history about a trillion barrels of oil. The U.S. Geological Survey estimates there is still 7 to 8 times that left in the ground. The oil that's left is just more difficult and therefore more expensive to get to. But that sets the invisible hand of the market into motion. Every time known reserves start looking tight, the price goes up, which incentivizes investment in research and development, which yields more sophisticated technologies, which unearth new supplies, often in places we'd scarcely even thought to look before. Now, I'm sure that a lot of people will say that this article is just basically the mainstream media taking its marching orders from the energy industry, and that this is just a simple-minded hit piece on the notion of peak oil. I'm going to read just one more paragraph, a short one, from later in the article. The author writes, "The energy industry is affected by so many complex, interconnected factors that it's as impossible to predict long-term as the weather. Tensions in any number of places in the Middle East could explode. China could slip into a recession and see its energy consumption plummet. Another major accident in the Gulf of Mexico could shut down deep water production in the U.S. But one thing we do know, there are plenty of fossil fuels left. And sooner or later, we'll get to them. Human beings are not going to stop driving or using plastic. The mushrooming middle classes in China, India, and elsewhere want their cars and air conditioners too. Petroleum consumption in China alone has doubled in the past decade, making it the world's second largest consumer behind the U.S. In the next 20 years, barring unforeseen economic calamity, world energy demand is expected to increase by anywhere from a third to a half. And most of the increase will be met with oil and natural gas. Wind, solar, and other renewable sources have miles to go before they make up a major part of the world's energy mix, and they are having a harder time than ever competing now that natural gas is dirt cheap." So what do you think? Is it silly and somewhat quaint to continue to fret over peak oil now that technology has opened the floodgates to all of this new supply? Is there a useful conversation to be had around the topic of peak oil? These are the questions which motivated my most recent conversation with Mark Rabinowitz. That conversation begins right now.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
You are listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO. I'm speaking once again with Mark Rabinowitz of oilempire.us. Mark, welcome back to the Sea Realm Podcast.
Thanks, and happy Earth Day to you and the listeners.
This will be airing on Wednesday the 24th, which I think is a day or two after Earth Day, but we can make it Earth Week.
Well, here in Oregon, our governor made an official proclamation that this is Earth Week, and we are supposed to be excited by that. And meanwhile, our governor, who is a Liberal Democrat, is pushing for accelerated logging of public forests and expanded highways, even though we're having some problems with the energy system keeping everything powered. So every day is Earth Day, but every day is not sifting through and understanding what is ecological and what is merely greenwashing, the false claim of claiming to be environmental.
Yes, to be green or an environmentalist of some stripe, particularly in politics, doesn't require a whole lot other than the use of a few buzzwords, as far as I can tell.
Well, even a lot of Republicans these days who clearly have no interest in pushing environmental policies claim to be environmental. It's like being in favor of motherhood and apple pie and so forth, yet actually recognizing that there are specific reasons why we have not been environmental is much more difficult. Unfortunately, a lot of the climate groups seem to only think that as long as climate change's reality is admitted, then nothing else needs to be dealt with. So politicians who promote incinerators or logging or highway expansion or expanding the number of wars we're in around the world, they can have a get-out-of-jail-free card if they merely admit that climate change is real, because there's some politicians elsewhere who deny that climate change is real, but the debate is not between whether climate change is real or not. The real issue is we have overshot our carrying capacity on the Earth. We're past peak energy, and we are past the limits to growth on a round, finite planet, which is a topic that rarely gets any airtime, even in the alternative press.
I have received emails with links to magazine and newspaper articles in them recently saying basically that peak oil has been proven wrong, that we have enough petroleum recoverable now with the new technology and deep drilling and that sort of thing, that we, the United States will be the new Saudi Arabia of petroleum, and that we have basically nothing to worry about on the energy front, but now we really have to focus our attention on climate. In fact, Bill McKibben published an essay saying just that in Rolling Stone just recently.
Well, it is a great example of disconnection from mathematics. It is certainly true that fracking for unconventional oil has increased oil production in the United States of America. However, oil peaked in the United States around 1970, 71, at about 10 million barrels a day. What fracking has done has changed the shape of the downslope of the decline of oil. There's been a spike from around 6 million barrels a day. Now it's around 7 million barrels a day. But what the peak oil deniers do not understand is that most fracked wells conk out really quickly. Now, McKibben and the other environmental groups who are objecting to fracking for oil and gas, they correctly note that it is highly polluting of groundwater. Pumping toxic solvents 2 miles into the earth and blowing up rock destroys aquifers, and cleaning up aquifers is virtually impossible to do. But it also takes a tremendous amount of energy to get oil and gas out of the ground through fracking, much more energy invested for energy return than conventional oil. And even if we disregarded all of the environmental concerns about fracking, there is no physical way that fracking is going to negate the reality of peak oil. And I don't know any peak oil expert who has said that oil depletion means we don't have to worry about fossil fuel pollution. Indeed, if you look at the limits to growth study from 1972, it predicted not only that we would reach the beginning of resource constraints around the turn of the century, which is what has happened, it also predicted that the peak of pollution would come after the peak of resources. And with tar sands in Canada and fracking in the United States, this is a great example of how now that the easy to extract oil is being replaced by the more difficult to extract oil, the remaining fossil fuels are dirtier than the earlier, cheaper, easier to extract material. Now, McKibben should know better because he has been at a number of events where experts in climate and experts in peak energy have been brought together to try to get a synthesis. The most recent was a conference in D.C. called Triple Crisis, where he shared the stage with Richard Heinberg and a number of others who have discussed peak energy. And McKibben is also a fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute, which a few months ago published a very detailed technical report called Drill Baby Drill about the fracking bubble, and that fracked wells do not last as long as regular wells. It's not just an issue of fracking is toxic. It also requires a tremendous amount of money and of technical skills and physical resources to continue to frack. Now, if we were to ban fracking and ban tar sands in Canada, I would approve. Most environmentalists would approve. However, there's a consequence to that. Fossil fuels are more energy dense than living on our solar budget. I'm using solar electricity to communicate with you on the telephone. But between my solar-powered telephone and computer here and your station in New York is the electric grid. And the electric grid is totally powered by fossil fuels. Coal and natural gas are the bulk of it. You also have nuclear power. Wind and solar are certainly nice, but they are a tiny fraction, almost infinitesimal, especially solar.
Well, I mentioned that I've been getting links to articles, one of which very prominently was by Bill McKibben, saying basically that new recovery and extraction technology is going to allow us to continue the fossil fuel way of life for hundreds of years to come, and that we can't really count on peak oil to keep us from destroying the environment and filling the atmosphere with so much carbon that we'll have a runaway greenhouse effect to deal with. So peak oil, according to Bill McKibben and folks who are basically saying the same thing, is not an issue any longer, that we really need to focus our attention on climate and get off of fossil fuels voluntarily as fast as we can.
Well, the rise in the price of oil and the decline of the world's major oil fields, the supergiant fields, has been an enormous motivator to the oil industry to go after the more difficult to extract resources. So there's still plenty of oil to find, but it's the low-hanging fruit argument. If you have a fruit tree that is full of apples, do you go get your fruit ladder at harvest time and climb to the very tippy top of the fruit tree and get the apple that's 30 feet above the ground, or do you eat first the apples that you don't need the fruit ladder and you just walk by and grab them? So we have eaten the low-hanging fruit of fossil fuels, and now we're going after the much more difficult. I mean, the idea that oil companies are excited about drilling in a mile or deeper of ocean or super deep on land or Arctic oil or going after low-quality shale oil with fracking, you know, no one is, peak does not mean the oil is gone. It means we cannot increase the consumption any more than we already are. We have more fossil energy now than we've ever had or will ever have again. If you climb to the top of a tall mountain and you're at the summit, you have a great view, but you can't get any higher. And we are on that plateau of peak energy, and fracking and other unconventional oil supplies have extended the plateau a little bit longer. And we'll see which geologists are correct in terms of how long fracking can continue. But nobody who's looked at the technical data is saying that it's negated peak oil. It's merely changed the shape of the downslope. Another aspect of peak with fracking is, are we using the resources that are taken out of the ground from fracking as a bridge towards a lower energy future? You know, it takes fossil fuels to make solar panels and wind turbines and move them around and install them. Or are we using what's coming from fracking as just another short-term fix for our addiction to growth and highways and Walmart and militarism? So in 2007, as the price of energy started to increase, the United States hit peak energy for all sources, fossil fuels and all the rest. We also hit peak electricity in 2007. And we also hit peak traffic for automobiles, vehicle miles traveled. This all happened because the price went up, not because we suddenly became concerned about our environmental footprints or the melting ice caps and so forth. But as the economy takes a bite, there's also more support for doing whatever we can to try to restore the consumption. So we end up with tar sands and fracking. We end up with environmental regulations being ignored or repealed. We end up with a more desperate approach to trying to maintain what we used to have. So the fact that for example, traffic has peaked, did not result in a slowdown of spending on highway expansion. In fact, we are spending more now under Obama than we even spent under George Bush Jr. There's $1 trillion of new and expanded highways in the pipeline around the United States, and no community anywhere that I can find, and I've looked for 20 years, has canceled any road projects because of deep energy or climate. Sometimes you can find a road project that gets postponed because there's not enough money to pay for all of this overshoot.
That seems like just one example of the larger pattern of Obama being able to enact more regressive right-wing policies than any Republican ever could and do it with the blessing of supposedly progressive Democrats.
Well, as I've said all along, I'm not in the slightest bit disappointed by Obama. It seemed pretty obvious when he was first announced as a candidate that he would be the good cop to Bush's bad cop, yet the policies on the national security state are virtually the same. Now, there's some cosmetic tertiary issues where it's different, but as Martin Luther King said in 1963, we need to judge people on the content of their character, not the color of their skin. And a lot of liberals who voted for Obama, I think, are looking mostly at race, so-called, and skin color, or they're so delighted to have George Bush out of the White House that they're not noticing that a lot of the same policies are still there. And there's just some policies that are different, but on a number of others, Obama is much more effective at getting them through, just as Clinton and Gore were able to get through NAFTA and the World Trade Organization and a number of other regressive policies that Reagan and Bush were unable to do. Because when Republicans are in the White House, the environmental movement usually does not roll over and play dead. Whereas having Democrats in the White House, most of the big environmental groups are unwilling to challenge them. It also has to do with the funding that a lot of the big organizations get. Most of the big environmental groups, especially the ones in Washington, D.C., get money from the fossil fuel industry, laundered through their philanthropic foundations like Rockefeller, Ford, the Pew Charitable Trust, which is the Sun Oil Company, or Sunoco, and others. And for them to make a substantial challenge to the system, they would have to give up their addiction to foundation funding. Because most of these organizations, if you send them $50 as a membership, that's not what funds them. It's the foundation world that funds them. So they have a control mechanism that ensures they have limits to their dissent or their advocacy.
I spoke with Paul Kingsnorth a few weeks ago. He is the proponent of the notion that environmental, so-called environmental groups are basically all pro-technology and pro-growth and pro-economic development these days, just with a green flavor.
One of the biggest heresies in our society, whether you're an environmental establishment activist or almost anywhere else, is to admit that the earth is round and therefore finite. We live in an economy and a system that is predicated on exponential growth. And exponential growth was very effective for a century, but it cannot continue any longer. And this is not because it's a bad idea. It's because we have reached peak everything. We've reached peak oil globally. We've passed peak coal in the United States and probably close to it globally. Peak conventional gas is passed in the United States, natural gas. We're even near peak uranium. We're also at peak renewable resources, peak soil, peak fresh water, peak fish in the oceans, peak food, getting close to that. So we're using everything as fast as we possibly can. And the idea that we have now collided into these physical limits is a heresy everywhere, because we would have to admit that the way that we're all living, self included, is destroying the future. And that is profoundly troubling, not just because our economy is based on this, but because to admit that we are all part of the problem, you know, it's much. We did a show a few months back about peak blame, and it's much more fun to blame the corporations or to blame the government or to blame the 1% or the 47% in Romneyville or somebody other than the guy in the mirror, because we're all part of the problem. And one of the other objections I have to where the environmental movement has wandered is the idea that we can somehow get off fossil fuels without having to make substantial changes in the way that we live. I've used solar energy over 20 years. It's great, but it does not move food across time zones and international borders. And I'm convinced the only solar-powered airplanes are going to be drones. They're not going to be Boeings full of holidaymakers going to the Caribbean. Now, if we were smart, we would put up solar panels and wind turbines as much as we can, but that would power a steady state, relocalized society, not one based on endless growth on a finite planet.
So long I tried to click on the lights, but they won't go on. It doesn't seem like there is much I can do, 'cause the owner of this place lets the darkness seep right through. Yeah, moving's such a chore. Take my calls, but I still phone every day. Somebody's got to listen to my complaint. Nothing will happen if you're quiet as a mouse, but I've been like a hippo knocking about this house. Yeah, moving such a
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast with your host, KMO.
You are listening to the Sea Realm podcast. I'm your host, KMO. I'm speaking with Mark Rabinowitz. Mark, I have read a great many things, of course. You pick any issue, any topic, any question, and you can find people who give the answer which is emotionally satisfying to you and do so using big words and very facile arguments. And so I've been reading recently from various quarters the notion that regardless of what you think about infinite growth on a finite planet, the piece of the apparatus of infinite growth to break first is not going to be petroleum supply. That because we have better ways of extracting and locating petroleum, that we really need to turn our focus elsewhere to more pressing concerns. And I think that is the gist of Bill McKibben's message in his Rolling Stone article. Do you think that petroleum and peak petroleum is the most urgent issue that we face right now?
I think peak denial is the most urgent issue that we face right now. Petroleum, most people don't even know what petroleum is or where it comes from or how it gets to them or how it powers their lives other than they grumble if they have to buy it at a gasoline station. The fact that it runs the food system that keeps their bellies full is not something that is part of our culture. And that's true whether you are a liberal Democrat or a conservative Republican or, for that matter, a Green or any other flavor of politics. My view on is that we need to look at peak and climate together, not separately. Because if you only focus on peak, then the obvious solution is we should do tar sands and fracking and mountaintop removal and offshore drilling, because that would be needed to make up for the decline of the oil fields. And that is obviously bad for the planet, not just because of carbon, but fossil fuels are toxic. It's not just that they emit carbon that is increasing the greenhouse effect. It is also increasing cancer and birth defects. But if you only focus on climate and ignore energy, it leads to a different backlash. The climate movement is framing these concerns as we should reduce energy by the year 2050, and some of them argue, well, maybe it should be 2040 or even 2030. Well, we're going to reduce energy consumption, whether it's Dennis Kucinich or Dick Cheney making the decisions, because you cannot burn fuel that does not exist. And the unconventional sources, such as fracking and tar sands, are not physically capable of replacing the major oil fields that were found over the last several decades. They can mitigate some of the decline, but they're not going to reverse it and give us a second peak in the year 2030. That's just not physically possible. And if we were to look at how we will use the remaining oil, do you want solar relocalization or Walmarts and highways and warfare, that might be able to bypass some of the problems of climate change denial. In other words, if we were to use the remaining fossil fuels for a sort of global permaculture approach rather than a globalization and warfare approach, that might inspire more people than arguing over is climate change real or not. Plus, also a lot of the climate-only groups are saying that the world is going to be wrecked by climate if we don't shift, and then they offer very milquetoast approaches. It would be as if you were in New York City last fall on the beach and someone told you that there was a hurricane coming through, and you might want to consider buying an umbrella at some point. You could either assume that the warning about the storm was wrong and ignore what they said, or if you accepted the storm warning was correct, you could realize that what they were recommending to do about it was insufficient as a response. And that's an analogy for where most of the climate movement is. You know, I don't see 350 and the other groups using their organizational resources to promote transition town type approaches. They're not teaching people how to tear up their lawns and grow food, or set up cooperatives to share tools, or car co-ops, or campaigning against highway expansion, or a thousand other things that we will all need to do everywhere to reduce gracefully our consumption of fossil fuels and minerals.
I had somebody on the program recently. His name is Dan Miner. He is the founder of the New York City Peak Oil Awareness Meetup Group. And he was talking about message discipline. And I had raised an objection that I thought a lot of the things that he was trying to communicate to his fellow New Yorkers were seriously inadequate compared to the challenges that we face and the predicament that we've painted ourselves into with our dependence on fossil fuels and a variety of other issues. And he agreed, but he also said that, and I've heard this from other people who are working to push alternative energy, that if you were to tell the average person on the street, who, as you correctly pointed out, doesn't even really know what petroleum is, much less what role it plays in their lives, if you were to tell them the full scope of the situation and what would really be needed in order to ameliorate it, that it's so far beyond what they're even willing to consider that they would just immediately tune out. And so, or they would just lapse into despair and just sort of futility motivated inaction. And that people like Bill McKibben, who are really soft pedaling the issues and proposing very inadequate responses, are basically just setting the stage for a future conversation about what really needs to be done.
Well, I don't have an ideological objection to that argument. At least that's not the basis of it. My objection is that the peak and climate for dummies approach isn't working. I mean, if the argument that, well, we have to soft pedal this because people can't handle the full story, if that was working to shift the way our society is being structured, I might grumble and go, okay, well, that's not my approach, but it's working, so I'll support it. But it's not working. There's less discussion of energy limits now than there was in the United States before the peak. And the climate movement is sadly become mostly a cheering section for a particular political party that isn't going to do anything. And there's very little understanding that we're not addicted to fossil fuels. We are totally dependent on fossil fuels. In the United States, we use about 100 quads a year. And a quad is 1 quadrillion BTUs. And the British thermal unit is roughly equivalent to striking a match. So it's a quadrillion, which is a very big number. Out of the 100 quads per year that we collectively use in the United States, 0.1% comes from solar, and about 1% comes from wind. There's a little more that comes from hydroelectricity and burning biomass, which has its own problems. And the rest is fossil fuels, with a little bit of nuclear power on the side. That consciousness is not being promoted anywhere that I can see. Now, if people want to do small steps toward the bigger goal of shifting our use of fossil fuels, it would be nice to see these organizations use their communication skills to spread community gardens, tearing up suburban lawns to grow vegetables and car cooperatives and pushing more transit and stopping highways and all the different aspects of transition town. But transition town strategies are not embraced by most of the climate movements. As far as I can tell, most of the climate message is, if we get everyone to admit that we are causing climate change, then somehow a miracle will happen and we will get off fossil fuels and we'll live happily ever after. That's magical thinking. And it doesn't help with the logistics of relocalizing food production so that we can reduce fossil fuels without causing too much suffering.
There's also this notion that public awareness of climate change runs ahead of the general awareness of peak oil and other energy issues because the project of mitigating climate change can be turned into an excuse for economic growth, for building green products, for selling green services, and it's really hard to do that with peak oil.
There's a great commentary from David Holmgren, who is the co-originator of the permaculture concept, who has written about the interconnections of climate and peak as well as anybody on the planet. And he has said that many of those involved in money and markets have begun to rally around climate change as an urgent problem that can be turned into another opportunity for economic growth of a green economy. These same people have tended to resist even using the term peak oil, let alone acknowledging its imminent occurrence. Perhaps this denial comes from an intuitive understanding that once markets understand that future growth is not possible, then it's game over for our fiat system of debt-based money. That is from David Holmgren in Australia, co-originator of permaculture. And I think that summarizes it perfectly, because if climate change is merely going to be solved by swapping out coal and oil and natural gas for solar panels and wind turbines, well, then we can continue on our merry way to the techno-utopian singularitarian Wall-E future that we all dream of. Whereas if there are physical limits to keep consuming the earth, then the idea that we can continue to increase our consumption becomes ridiculous. And we have a monetary system that can conjure up digital dollars and euros out of thin air, but if those digital currencies are not backed by an actual physical economy, then we end up with a speculation economy that can spiral into hyperinflation or other problems. The physical economy cannot increase as fast as the digital money. And that is part of the elephant in the living room about overshoots. My guess is the economy limits will hit faster than the energy limits. And in the long run, it will be the ecological crash after the peaks of money and even energy. And it's not only climate that we need to be concerned about in terms of the environmental impacts. There's also the toxic impacts of making all these toxic chemicals and nuclear waste. There's also the extinctions that we are causing from deforestation, overfishing, and other environmental problems. And climate is part of the problem, but it's not the only part of the environmental problem.
I think there's a big push to focus on climate and particularly atmospheric carbon, because that can be addressed, not necessarily improved, but certainly addressed with a cap and trade carbon credit trading regime and markets. And basically the notion of a green movement can be used to motivate a new speculative bubble in something which is completely abstract and probably not really connected to anything physical at all, which is trading carbon credits.
Well, I have some photovoltaic panels, solar electric panels, and they do not sequester any carbon back into the earth. In fact, to buy them and then have them moved across time zones to my house took fossil fuels to make them and move them. It took minerals to make them. It took fossil fuels and minerals to make the electronics that control them. But my favorite spoof of the idea of carbon credits is from Britain. There's a website called cheatneutral.com, which if you are in a monogamous relationship and you're having problems being monogamous, you can pay someone else to be monogamous on your behalf and thus offset the amount of cheating in the atmosphere. And the funniest thing about this website is that they got some media inquiries, especially from the U.S., from media who thought it was real and not a spoof. And, of course, this is sarcasm, but the idea that we can somehow offset burning fossil fuels, when fossil fuels are dug out of the earth and put into the biosphere, the only way we could actually offset that would be as if that carbon were somehow sequestered back into the crust of the earth, and nobody is doing that. The way to sequester fossil fuels is to leave them in the ground. And it would be nice to leave the remaining fossil fuels in the ground. But if we were to sequester the existing fossil fuels and not dig them up, which is the message of the climate movement, the alternatives to fossil fuels are going to be less energy dense. They're not going to run the long-distance food transport. They're not going to run the aviation system. They're not going to run a lot of the things that we have become accustomed to using. And the difficulty of that is understood, ironically, a lot better by the industry people than the climate movement. Now, I'm sure some of the climate leaders, McKibben, I suspect, knows this, understand this privately, but they're not willing to say it in public because it's not a happy message. And happy messages are easier to sell in an infantilized society than dealing with reality. But if we don't deal with the reality of where we are, it's pretty unlikely we're going to have approaches to the crisis that actually are relevant.
Could it be that most people are not amenable to anything that doesn't come with at least a potential happy message embedded in it, and are therefore not really even potentially useful participants in the discussion of what to do, and really shouldn't be included in the discussion?
Well, I think that's part of the peak denial and the traumatic psychology that we are in as a society. Is intuitively, I think most people realize that the way we all live is stealing from the future. There are probably very few people who don't have at least a suspicion about that. But there's a lot. One of the things that could be done to break some of that denial down is most people like to eat, and most people in the United States have access to small patches of lawn or know people who have access to patches of lawn. And relocalizing food is probably the top priority for dealing with climate and peak and what's euphemistically called recession. And food that comes straight out of the garden as opposed to food that was picked in another time zone and sent to you tastes a lot better. You can get Republicans and Democrats to agree on that for the most part. And teaching people how to provide at least a little bit of their own sustenance is probably one of the biggest antidotes to the paralysis that we all have been subjected to. It's not going to solve the problem, but it would help start gearing up the response, because this is not something that a tiny percentage of the country growing their own vegetables or riding a bicycle or whatever else they're going to be doing. These are all nice, but it's going to have to be a system-wide response, not a boutique type of thing for people on the 350 email list or people who have donated to the Sierra Club or similar entities. Peak oil is not an issue that you can either be interested in or ignore. These are fundamental shifts in the way civilization is structured that are affecting everyone, whether you care about it or not.
It's an interesting challenge to keep one's motivation up, because I've done a lot of shows on peak oil to the point where, for the most part, I'm not interested in doing another show which just tells people that the problem is real and that we need to address it and that it has some far-reaching implications that they might not be aware of. because I've been doing this show for 7 years now, and actually 6 years. And 6 years into it, you know, 19 out of 20 people on the street, if I were to go out and just poll them, have not heard the phrase peak oil. They don't have any clue as to the role that petroleum really plays in their life, the extent that it plays. And it's just a conversation. It's sort of like when you go to ASPO, and it's the first couple days are just peak oil 101, explaining what it is. It's such a hard thing to stay interested in, even if one grasps the implications and grasps what needs to be done. Talking to people who aren't already sort of fetishistic about it is always starting at, you know, kindergarten level discussions, and it just gets so tedious and boring. I wonder what you think about communication strategies for the people in the know to the rest of the civilization.
It seems that in this time of peak everything and peak communication, peak technology, that we should be engaged in as much discussion as possible in strategy and cross-fertilization to try to figure out how can we live as we realize we've hit all of these limits, energy and environment and money, how to live more gently, more ethically, in a way that future generations will still have a planet on which to live on. There are tiny amounts going on for that, but they're mostly disconnected from each other. And the climate people look at the peak people with suspicion, and some of the peak people look at the climate people with suspicion. And a lot of the economic justice people don't look at the limits to growth, and so forth. These are all different aspects of the same disconnection from each other, disconnection from physical reality, disconnection from understanding basic mathematics, high school level math. One other thing about money is money is very useful as a symbol, but the more that money gets financialized and disconnected from the physical resources it supposedly represents, it becomes more and more symbolic and abstract. And so the idea that we can have $1 trillion in digital money going around the world every day between stock markets, that's not $1 trillion of actual resources, it's just ones and zeros in computer networks. The idea that we have almost $1 quadrillion in derivatives sitting there in the financial system, I don't even know what sort of adjective to use to describe how insane that is. Because there's not $1 quadrillion of physical resources backing up that debt. It reminds me of the hyperinflation in Zimbabwe, where at the final crash of that economic system, they joked that they were starving billionaires. You would need billions of dollars to buy an egg for lunch. And there was no real value to that money, but it had a lot of zeros in it. One analogy of a steady state economy is in an ecosystem that has reached its carrying capacity, such as an old growth forest, you have growth and decay in balance. And so an economy that was based on what the physical world could provide would be a monetary system that did not involve currency that was constantly expanding. This is a type of economic system that would be more fair in the long run and in more in tune with what nature could provide, but it would involve a complete transformation of the way money is created through being loaned into an existence with debt and compound interest.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast. Turn on, tune in, and take heart.
That was Mark Rabinowitz, and the voice encouraging you to turn on, tune in, and take heart was that of Black Beauty, one of my fellow podcasters over at the Dope Fiend Network. As you could probably tell from my conversation with Mark Rabinowitz, I'm having trouble staying engaged in a conversation with people who either don't think very deeply about the sustainability of petroleum-enabled industrial civilization, or who only think about one aspect of it and disparage people who come at it from different points of view. As Mark pointed out, The peak oil people are critical of those in the environmental movement for their blithe endorsement of the infinite growth paradigm. The environmental groups, who live on foundation money, don't want to cut the peak oil people in on any of that action. They don't want to be associated with the peak oil issue because peak oil is a bummer, and it does not play well with the public or with the captains of industry and finance, who are more than happy to work with environmentalists to put a green happy face on business as usual or to make carbon credits the focus of the next speculative boom. Those folks don't want to hear about powering down, making do with less, relocalizing or recognizing limits to growth. And people concerned with social justice issues would much rather talk about a more equitable distribution of a growing pie than grapple with how to lock in the hard-won civil rights gains of the 20th century in a sustained period of economic contraction, uncertainty, and heightened competition. And almost nobody who isn't looking to profit from financial speculation has any interest in trying to wrap their minds around the issues of debt-based money, international finance, or the consequences of having an economy based on abstract speculation that dwarfs the economy based on the production of tangible goods and services. And yet, navigating the crises of our age will require that we consider climate, fossil fuels, economics, human psychology, rapid and profoundly destabilizing technological progress, politics, and other issues I have not yet thought to research or include in the ongoing CROM conversation. It seems that very few people are interested in that kind of multidisciplinary conversation, one in which certainty is elusive and never to be trusted, one without a preordained happy ending or a hefty infusion of self-congratulation, one that identifies and quarantines deliberate distractions like gun control, gay marriage, and other tertiary issues over which the dominant factions make a show of opposing one another while marching in lockstep on issues of growth, money, and militarism. Hanging tough, and not only staying engaged with that conversation, but trying to scratch out a living with it, isn't easy. Messages like the one I received from Nancy really help me keep my spirits up and stay engaged. Nancy writes, "Your podcast is fantastic. I am totally addicted. As soon as I find work, I will send in a larger contribution. I have certainly received far, far more than my tiny monthly payment. I've spent the past 7 years fighting coal and the utilities, and I'm tired and looking for a more spiritual understanding of what is going on. Thanks so much for the amazing insights and interviews. Rock on, Nancy." Thank you, Nancy. And really, I should have thanked Nancy at the top of the program, as she's signed up for a $3 a month subscription to the CROM podcast. The $3 subscription level is something that I implemented and promoted in 2008. I haven't said anything about it recently, and there's nothing about it on CRealm.com, but people who follow the PayPal link from the CRealm podcast page on Podomatic can still find that $3 a month subscription option. And I guess that's what Nancy did. Thank you, Nancy. Your support means the world to me. Well, I'm just about out of time for this episode. I have mentioned in recent weeks that Olga and I would be attending the Age of Limits gathering in Artemis, Pennsylvania over Memorial Day weekend. We will not. Although Mark Rabinowitz tells me that he is likely to attend. I don't say it every week, but this episode and every episode of the CROM podcast is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 license, which means that it is available for you to use in your own creative projects. I hope that you will make use of it, that you will share what you learn, that you will find the others and bring them into this conversation, and most importantly, that you will join me 1 week from today for another installment of the CROM podcast. And until that time, stay well.